Okay, we're going to get Dave situated in the chair here. My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. And we are so excited. We don't have a clue what we're going to do, but we're so excited. Well, Dave knows what he's going to do, to be here and to share the gifts of family recovery. And I am so excited to be here at Lake Lanier. Dick, and I just am so grateful for everything you do and what you guys do to get this thing going for all of us. It's just amazing. And I just want to thank you guys for being here. And I'm going to introduce Dave first. And what Dave's going to do is he's going to talk about men are like waffles and women are like spaghetti. And he's going to talk about the differences in men and women. And if you want some recovery, family recovery in a marriage, you better know that. Okay. All right. Come on.
Am I high enough? I don't know. What do you got?
Yeah.
Well, good. We can pull this to you.
Oh, yeah. Look at this. Hi, everybody. My name is Dave, and I know I don't look like it, but I'm an alcoholic. I got my last minute marching orders just then. I have to stay within the mic. You hear that? Okay. The reason I'm gimping around and rolling around is because I'm getting old, and you can't use a human body as long as I've been using mine without it getting a ding and a dent and a crack here and there. So it's all right. I'm here. You're here. What could be better than that? Good to see you, Dick. This is a little... thing I'm going to start with. Polly had the name right. Men are like waffles, women are like spaghetti. That doesn't literally mean what it says, but well, you'll see. I was born in Dallas, Texas in 1936. And for all you math majors, that's 83 years. Can you believe that? Who the hell was to be 83? And my sobriety day is April the 18th, 1976, that's right. How did you know? Ha, yeah. I wandered in and had no idea where I was, where I was going, what I was going to do. And, of course, it wasn't my first time. My first time in AA was in Corpus Christi, Texas, and... went in there and some guys stuck around to indoctrinate me or, you know, show me the ropes. And this one guy says, well, you know, every morning I would stop at the liquor store and buy all the half pints that I could fit under the seat of my pickup. And that was my ration for the day. And what am I doing here? I don't even have a pickup. So, you know, that's the way we are. I was born in Dallas, Texas, St. Paul's Hospital. And I hope my first few years they weren't typical of the time. You know, there's a lady named Ann Miller who wrote some books on the subject, and she talked about how men, and she made a reference to Adolf Hitler of all things, and said that, you know, a lot of the reason he was the way he was because of the way he was raised. And so that's her story, it's not mine, and she was of the opinion that that would cause us serious mental and intellectual damage. And I'll leave you to make up your own mind on that. But How are you to understand the differences between men and women? We like to think of them this way. Men are like waffles and women are like spaghetti. And at first this may seem silly, even juvenile. But stay with us. Here's a picture that works and men get it. Maybe because it involves food. My first residence was Dallas, Texas, and I lived there until I was, I think, about 8 years old. Moved to Houston, there 3 years, moved to Kingsville, all these are in Texas. Moved to Kingsville, that lasted 3 years. Moved to Corpus Christi, that lasted 3 years. And went to California and said, well, you know, see you later, Mom. And I had no intention of ever coming back. In fact, I hadn't even thought it out that far. Am I coming back? How the hell do I know? I don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. So, my second blissful trip into holy matrimony was with a lady in Corpus Christi, Texas. She was from Michigan originally. And she was okay. Well, I could have used more colorful language and get you closer to the truth, but my version of the truth. But I didn't go too far, you know. When her boss called me and told me some things like she was embezzling money, and I wasn't getting any of it. That was a deal breaker. Hi, Christy. The next one was a lady from Anadarko, Oklahoma. You know. So people say, how do you find these with us? Well, you can't find them on Rodeo Avenue. You know, you got to dig around. And we never did get off to a very good start. You know, her ex-husband was a truck driver, and she had overtones of his vocabulary. Which wasn't all that neat. I don't know when was the last time you heard truck drivers shoot the breeze, but it's a little riper than that. And she just really drank like I did. And we were at a company Christmas party, and she said, dance with me, and I started dancing with her. And she said, I'm going to take you home with me. And, you know, there are times in your life, I'm sure, if you're sitting in this room and have identified as an alcoholic, that seemed like a really good deal. So, we were married for a few years. Then I met a lady from Salt Lake City, and she was not long lasting. And then I had joined AA by that time, and I've been going to AA for a few years, and a couple of years, 3 years. That's a few. And she walks right up to me and said, hi, my name's Polly. Welcome to AA. Do you see any daggers flying through the air? And she was a program of attraction. And so she and I became very good friends, and along the trail somewhere we fell in love. And we just decided we probably could go on with our life without the other, but we just didn't want to. Couldn't see it. So we just You okay? So, we just, it was a classic AA move that we made for two newly sober people. I think Polly had about a year and I had three. So we were up into the wisdom decision category. And so we made one, and it turned out to be the best thing I ever did, and I'll let her speak for herself, but it's the best thing I ever did. I can't imagine a life without her. How dull it must have been. I mean, my first few outings were just not good. You know, they were just dreadful. And so we wound up with a little... We've been married 38 years, and that's not a record, but it damn sure is for me. And I cannot imagine life without her. You know, the only thing I can recommend to you, if you are a male and looking for a mate, I hope you find somebody like Polly. They got a few scratchy corners, but they are just absolutely fabulous. And I can't imagine life without her. So, men are like waffles. We do not mean that men waffle on all decisions and are generally unstable. What we mean is that men process life in boxes, and if you look down at a waffle, that's what you see, a collection of boxes separated by walls. The boxes are all separated from each other and make convenient holding places. This is typically how a man processes life. Our thinking is divided up into boxes that have room for only one issue, and one issue only. The first issue of life goes in the first box, the second goes in the second box, and the typical man lives in one box at a time and one box only. When a man is at work, he is at work. When he is in the garage tinkering around, he is in the garage, just tinkering around. When he is watching TV, simply watching TV. That's why he looks like he's in a trance. And can ignore everything going on around him, and does. Especially if it's a good football game. Social scientists call this compartmentalizing, and that is putting life and responsibilities, the activities in your life, into different compartments. You only think about one of those things at a time. You don't. As a result, men are problem solvers by nature. They enter a box, and when you tell a man to go get a Phillips screwdriver, he doesn't come back with a blade, okay? He comes back with a Phillips. Anyway, as a result, men are problem solvers by nature. They enter a box and size up the problem and formulate a solution. And in their careers, they consider what it will take to be successful and focus on that. And that's the big myth. One of the big myths in the world today is that if you can somehow find a way to get your name in the top box or close to it on an organization chart, you'll be successful and you'll be happy. Not true, but we buy it. I bought it. So they look for the bottom line, and they just go straight for it. That's where the money is. And in decision-making, they look for an approach they can buy into and apply it as often as possible. A man will strategically organize his life in boxes and then spend most of his time in boxes he can succeed in. This is such a strong motivation for him. Now, he'll just seek out the boxes at work and ignore the boxes that confuse him or make him feel like a failure. For instance, a man whose career holds the possibility of success will spend more and more time at work at the expense of his family and his friends. problem, possibly. On the other hand, a man who always falls short at work or feels he never meets the expectations. I know a lot of, you know, I think that's one of the ways they try to motivate men now, is to tell them, that hint to them that they're not meeting your expectations. He may find out, however, he's pretty good at being lazy. He will then develop a commitment to being lazy because he knows he can do that today with the same proficiency as yesterday. Men also take a success approach to communication. If they believe they can successfully talk with their wives and reach a desirable outcome, they will be highly motivated to talk, to converse. If, on the other hand, the conversation seems pointless to him, or he finds understanding his wife impossible. I had a wife like that. I didn't know what the hell she was talking about most of the time. He loses his motivation and talks and clams up. That is why men come up with such profound things to say as, is there any point to this conversation? Is this conversation leading anywhere? Are we going anywhere with this? Is this conversation made up of statements that a man I can make out of frustration? Because men frequently do not know how to make a conversation with their wife or significant other work. I just don't know how to do it. So the success drive is why men find it so easy to develop hobbies that consume their time. If a man finds something he's good at, it makes him feel good about himself and his life. Because men tend to be good with mechanical and spatial activities, they get emotionally attached to building, fixing, and changing things. Yard projects become expressions of his personality. The car becomes his signature. Fishing becomes an all-time consuming pursuit of the right equipment, the right fishing spot, the right friends. You know, you can't just get a rod and reel and go out there and throw a dead shrimp in the water and count on anything. You got to know the stuff. You got to know how your reel stacks up against all reels. And I was a fisherman, I know, yeah. That's all we talked about when we were fishing. The computer stops being a tool at work as it transforms into an educational, entertaining, intimate friend. It makes predictable moves and gives predictable feedback because a man knows what he will get back from his computer. Hi, Mr. Spider. What's up, buddy? You didn't think it? He's not that big. God.
Wow.
Let's let him live.
Uh-oh. It's a big black widow.
But he's on the floor somewhere.
He's probably on the floor now.
Okay.
You may want to join us over here.
No, I'm brave. I'm going to hang in there. He didn't look like he had enough poison to kill me.
It's over there.
Oh, it was not a black widow.
That was
your
second wife, right?
Yeah. So, the success drive is why most men find it so easy to develop hobbies and things, fixing and chasing things. Yard projects become personal, you know, an expression of himself. Mr. Spider, you messed me up. Because a man knows what he will get back from his computer, he spends more and more time with his keyboard. Well, he spends less and less time face-to-face with his wife. It's true of me. That's how I earned my daily bread. I was a computer scientist. Certainly was true of me. In contrast to men's waffle-like approach, women possess life, process life more like a plate of pasta. If you look at a plate of spaghetti, you notice that there are lots of individual noodles. They're long and thin, and they all touch one another. If you attempted to follow one noodle around the plate, you would intersect a lot of other noodles. It's inevitable. And you might even switch to another noodle seamlessly without knowing it. That is how women face life. Every thought and issue is connected to every other thought and issue in some way. Life is much more of a process for women than it is for men. That's true. I've worked with a lot of women. That is why women are typically better at multitasking than men. She can simultaneously talk on the phone, prepare a meal, make a shopping list, work on the agenda for tomorrow's business meeting, give instructions to her children as they are going out to play, and close the door with her foot without skipping a beat. They do. You've seen them doing. You guys are laughing. So, because all her thoughts, emotions, and convictions are connected, she is able to process more information and keep track of more activities. You know, I mean, I have some little problems, developed some minor problems with my brain as a result of getting some of the new wonderful contemporary anesthesia. And I know it's true. They can do that. As a result, most women are in pursuit of connecting life together. They solve problems, but from a much different perspective than men. For women to quickly solve a problem when the issues involved in the discussion are disconnected from each other is an act of denial. And so women consistently sense the need to talk things through. In conversation, women can link together the logical, emotional, rational, and spiritual aspects of the issue. It just comes natural to her. In conversation, she not only links everything together, but this all comes to her naturally because it's always been that way with her, with women, I think. And this often creates a significant stress for a couple, because while she's making all the connections, he's frantically jumping boxes trying to keep up. The man's eyes are rolling back in his head while a tidal wave of information is swallowing him. When she is done, she feels better and he is overwhelmed. It's true. I'm getting some male heads going up and down. Joan comes home and says, "Honey, how was your day?" "I had a great day. We just committed to a new educational wing at the university, and I have been asked to oversee the budget. I am so excited they didn't rule me out because I'm a woman. You know, women have been fighting for a place in society for decades, and it's good to see so much progress is being made. I think it's neat that you treat the women who work for you with so much respect. Our daughter is so lucky to have you for a dad. Did you remember that Susie has a soccer game tonight? I think it's important that we are there because the Johnsons are going to be there, and I really want you to meet them. Susie and Bethany are becoming good friends, and I think we should get to know her parents as well." What the hell did she say? Oh, Mr. Spider is back. Hi, buddy. How you doing? Didn't like the floor, huh? As Joan is exploring the conversation, Dan's getting lost. The guy's getting lost. Uh-oh, they're going to scoop it out on me. See you later, Mr. Spider. Right, if you find work. That is raw courage. Dan has no idea what the budget at the university has to do with their daughter's soccer game and their need to have a friendship with the Johnsons. He admires her ability to connect seemingly unrelated thoughts, but he just can't seem to understand how she does it. One of the characteristics that create havoc in a male-female interaction is the fact that most men have boxes in their waffles that have no words. There's nothing in the words. There are thoughts in these boxes about the past, and their work, and pleasant experiences, but these thoughts do not turn into words. A man is quite happy to be... excuse me. Do we have any drops, cough drops, or hard candy? Sorry, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The man is able to be quite happy in these wordless boxes because the memories he carries in them have significant meaning to him. The problem is...
all this stuff going on.
So, so that's pretty much a caricature of how men think and act and face the world. Women, however, they tend to be loud. They talk loud, they love loud, and they just... you ever be in a car with five women, they're all talking at once? Everybody, all five are talking, not a damn one of them is listening. They're just all five talking at once. But when the conversation comes to an end, everybody knows what everybody else said. How do they do that? Most of all, not all wordless boxes have thoughts. There are actually boxes in the average man's waffle that contain no words and no thoughts. These boxes are just as blank as a white sheet of paper. They're empty. To help relieve stress in his life, he will park in these boxes to relax. Amazingly, his wife always seems to notice when he is in park. She observes his blank look and the relaxed posture he has taken on the couch. She assumes this is a good time to talk because he is so relaxed. And she invariably asks, "What are you thinking, sweetheart?" He immediately panics because he knows if he tells the truth, she'll think he's lying. She cannot imagine a moment without words in her mind. If he says nothing, she thinks he's hiding something and is afraid to talk about it. Who wouldn't be? She becomes instantly curious and mildly suspicious. Not wanting to disappoint his wife, his eyes start darting back and forth, hoping to find some box in close proximity that has words in it. If he finds a box of words, quickly he will engage his wife in conversation and both will feel good about the relationship. If he is slow in finding words, her suspicion fails to be extinguished and he feels a sense of failure. He desperately wants to explain to his wife that he sometimes just goes blank. Nothing's wrong. Nothing is in denial. Nothing's being hidden. This is the way he's been his whole life. She can't imagine that. Women are different by design. The differences are not limited to conversation. As our lives roll along, it becomes increasingly obvious that God made men and women different in many ways. They think differently, they process emotions differently, and they make decisions differently, and they learn differently. Yet men and women complement one another so beautifully that a healthy relationship makes both partners more complete. I believe that. It is said that the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is the most cherished and valuable. I thought she was going to whiz a drink out of it long. Unfortunately, we have all seen folks who are getting healthy individually, but who are in mixed relationships, marred relationships that are not emotionally nourishing. It has become our belief that the quality of our lives and those of our relationships will improve significantly through the use and practice of the 12 steps and the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when the 12 presents are presented as in 12 steps and 12 traditions. Commonly called the 12 and 12, where, what, how, and why of the belief based on our own experience. That's what we're... Did you do it? So, if there's one thought that I really want to leave you with, it's this. Men and women are different. and that extends farther than plumbing differences. Okay? They're just different. They do think differently. They do react differently to life than men do. And that's okay. That's good. You know, how would you like to be married to you? So, the boss now wishes to share her thoughts.
I'm going to help you.
I'm good.
Okay. Thank you, honey. Does everybody get men and waffles and spaghetti, and men and women are different? That's one of the best ways to figure out that he's not going to think like me. Took me a long time to figure out I need to go talk to a woman instead of him. He is not going to get it. So, anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit. I'm going to go next, and then James and Jane. And are you setting my clock for me so I know? But okay. We're trying to get you out of here, and we'll see if we can do it in 79 minutes. That's what we're trying to do. Anyway, one of the things that I'd like to say is that I love being married. I absolutely love being married. Dave and I have been married for 39 years, and I absolutely love being married. But I can tell you, I was married for 22 years before. And the difference in our marriage, the two marriages, has only to do with what I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I will assure you that my first husband was a wonderful man. The marriage did not fall apart because of him. That he was a wonderful man, he was a good dad, I mean, all of it was there. First of all, I had the disease of alcoholism. And one of the things that happens is the disease of alcoholism, as we learn, especially in the third step and in the doctor's opinion, is selfish, self-centered. It's always about me. It's self, self, self. I had no tools in which to be a partner and that relationship. Not only that, I was a military wife, and he was gone for years at a time. So what happened was I was in charge, and then he would come home, and I wasn't in charge. And so I had no tools in which to, I didn't know how to put those balls in the air. I had the disease of alcoholism. I had two sons that I absolutely could not, as time went on, take care of. So that, the disaster of that relationship, today I can see all the lessons that were learned from that. One of the things we're talking about today is gifts. There's so many gifts, and I feel like there was gifts between him and me when we divorced, the gift of forgiveness, the gift of forgiveness with my son. There's been so many gifts given in family recovery and our situation. There have been so many lessons learned and how to get out of self. And those lessons could not have been learned without the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no clue. Dave has been ill for 5 years. I have been able, sometimes not patiently, but I have been able to step up as a caregiver for Dave. My first husband was 100% disabled from the military. About 80% bedridden, wouldn't you say, James? About 80% bedridden. And I was incapable of taking care of him. Incapable. I was too selfish and self-centered. How does a selfish, self-centered alcoholic take care of a man who needs that kind of care? One of the things that I love about life and has experienced in my life is that God gives us do-overs. He lets us go in and do it again. And I am so grateful for that. I can be the very best mom I can be today for my adult sons. My sons were 16 and 14 when I got sober. I had already drugged them through a lifetime of alcoholism. They were teenagers, but today they are grown men with grown children. And the good news is I've had the opportunity to do do-overs. I'm telling you, my grandchildren are grown now, but I want you to know I was a roller coaster riding grandma. I was there with those grandkids. I couldn't wait for the kids to go take a vacation so I'd have them all to myself and they wouldn't be around so I could spoil them and do all the things that I didn't get to do when mine were little. It was so much fun. And that's what God gives us the opportunity to do. And today, I get to take care of Dave. And it's an absolute gift that I get to do that. That I get to be present. That I get to take care of him. I get to do the things that I couldn't do before. The gifts. I'm sitting here with my son and daughter-in-law. And I am so grateful for the relationship that I have with my son. Is he making faces? Yeah, I figured he's making faces.
Well, you said I'm sitting here.
I'm standing here and I've got my son and daughter-in-law, and I get to do the family afterwards. And James and I have done that a few times. And one of the things that we got to be able to experience that was something that I wasn't sure either one of us could get through is a couple of years ago, we got to speak in Australia and we were going to do a segment on the family afterwards. And Darren came up to us and he said, I want you to do it differently than you normally do it. And he said, I want you to talk about how each of your alcoholism affected the other. Other words, how did James' alcoholism affect me, and how did my alcoholism affect him? And we never done that. We had certainly never done it behind a microphone and in public. And both of us, it was an amazing for me. That would have to be what he says about it. But for me, it was an amazing healing. Because James started out, my mom, I'm going to tell the truth. And he said this in front of everybody. And I really don't want to hurt you, but I'm going to tell you how it was. And the deal is you get to heal from those things. You get to hear something in a different way, and you get to heal. And one of the things you can sit there and you can say, the gift of forgiveness, the gift that we get to have because we are sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we can behave differently, we can accept responsibility differently, we can be accountable. And I can hear those things, and I can see how far we've come. And he can hear how his alcoholism affected me. I mean, I was so crazy when I was five, when before he got sober, and I had my two sons. I'm going to talk about. I want to say this because I kind of want to. I went and got the flyer here from the butterfly meeting, because we had an Al-Anon meeting earlier, and this is a family meeting, and a lot of times I don't talk about this because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but Barbara and Toledo, she was sitting up here, and Joy were our three. I'd heard Barbara many times, and I know Barbara's story, and I've been around her to talk about Al-Anon. But I'm going to throw in a little bit with me. I was 5 years sober, and I was on my way to an AA meeting, and my daughter-in-law of my oldest son called me. It's not his wife anymore, but she called me. And told me that my son was in the hospital, that he had put a pair of scissors in his stomach. Russ continued to try to take his life. And one way or another, he was so, whatever was going on with him. We know a lot of things today, but whatever was going on with him, he was just always trying to take his life in some way. My youngest son was living with us and was doing God knows what. He tells me I don't want to know, down on Venice Beach in California. And I just walked into that AA meeting, and it was one of those meetings that I hate today. But what happened was is that they said, does anybody have a problem? And I just detest those kind of meetings. But that day, and I was 5 years sober, I raised my hand. And I started talking about my daughter-in-law called about my son who was trying to commit suicide, and my son's running doing drugs down on Venice Beach, and both of my sons are dying, and I'm sober. And this guy in the back of the room said, well, you just need to let those boys go. And I flew out of my chair. I'm sure nobody ever did that. And I started screaming, you want to tell me how to do that? To let these boys go because they're dying. I know what that feels like. And what happens is God always shows up. God always shows up. And what happened is sitting in that meeting that night was a double winner. And she walked up to me and she said, Polly, I'm going to take you to an Al-Anon meeting. And what she did is the next day she picked me up and she took me to an Al-Anon meeting. And those women surrounded me. And they said, Polly, we're going to show you how to love your sons without it killing you. And I am so grateful because I was 5 years sober. And I can tell you, I was this close to a drink. I was that close. I was in so much pain that I didn't know if I could survive it. And that's what we get to do. We get to come into this program, we get to grow through the people that show up in our lives because they've worked the steps, they have the traditions in their life, and we continue to get these gifts. It's the same with what's happened in the last 5 years. By God's grace, I mean, Dave has walked as a lot of people in these rooms have. I know Dick has walked right up to the edge 4 times. And God continues to let him. I couldn't be here a year before last, or a couple of years ago. I can't even remember because we were in the middle of cancer surgery. How am I doing on time? Okay. And now, you know, Dave is sitting here speaking in a meeting. And that is amazing. And I thank you, Dick, for letting him do that. Because one of the things that Dave says, because he's still there, he says, you know, people don't come to me like they used to. And that's what happens. You know, we just get older and life happens. But the good news is we keep getting the gifts. We keep getting the gifts of sobriety. We keep just show up. You keep showing up no matter what. No matter how hard it gets, no matter what happens, we keep showing up and we keep doing the deal. And guess what? We keep getting the blessings. And I can tell you, always, you know, everything, just stay in today. That's what Joy said this morning. Just stay in today. And I can tell you, I am so grateful to be here with my family today. Today. And everybody is sitting right here. And I am so grateful for this program. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. James Lee, alcoholic.
My name.
Good to be here. Thank you, Dick, for inviting us. You know, when my mom started and said, we don't know what we're going to talk about, she was right. I have no idea what I'm going to say. So here we go. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the child of an alcoholic. That's my alcoholic parent right there. I'm a stepchild of an alcoholic. That's my step-parent right here. I'm a husband of an alcoholic. The jury's out on whether I'm a father of an alcoholic, but maybe I'll talk about that. And I'm a brother of an alcoholic. And I hope he doesn't get upset by this, but it's a special weekend this weekend for us as a family because Russ is going to have a year on Sunday. Do you know that? Yeah. He's probably really mad at me now, so don't let him listen to this CD. Okay. And I'm a friend of an alcoholic. Of course, that's not as far as the family goes, but a lot of my friends are like brothers, so. And I want you guys to know that was not my plan. I didn't like start my life thinking I'm going to be all those things. I can't wait. And then one day I'll be in Lake Lanier, Georgia, and it'll be fantastic. No, that was not my idea. As a matter of fact, when I was, maybe I'll talk a little bit about this, more tomorrow, but, when I was 14 and my mom started coming around to AA, I thought this is the lamest thing going. First of all, alcoholism was not what I wanted to deal with in my family. And second of all, I did not want to be an alcoholic myself. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I don't know if there's any way to describe that, if I'm to be truthful, without saying that it was hard, it was traumatic, it was difficult. And our big book speaks to that, right? You guys know that? It says somewhere in there. Family members are neurotic too, right? Any neurotic family members here? Am I by myself? Yes! I'm not alone! You know, it's not popular in AA to admit that, but that is the truth. And our book talks about that, and it is the truth. And I think alcoholism is a family illness. It's a family disease. And I think it's a family disease whether the alcoholic is drinking or not. And what I mean by that is my kids have never seen me take a drink, but they've seen me, disease of alcoholism manifest. Does anybody else relate to that? Non-drinking parental outbursts? I've had them. Here, you know what my definition of humility is? Having to apologize to your five-year-old for your childish behavior. That is humility. And I have done it multiple times. I've got three kids. I've done it multiple times with each one of them. So I believe alcoholism is a family disease. I believe that you can have it whether you drink or not. And I believe it's a disease that kills people. That's what I believe. And I believe it kills people whether you drink or not, too. I've seen that. And when I was 14 and I started to get introduced to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, that was not what I wanted to know. That was not what I wanted to believe. And I want to tell you, it was not what I wanted to live. And yet I was living it. And I remember as a teenager, I was angry. You know, I think most teenagers are angry. Mine were. But I took it to the next level. Yeah. You're laughing about that. I had this skill in anger when I was a teenager. But anyway, and then I, at the age of 15, found alcohol and drugs, and I found the answer to every problem I ever had. And there was just something about that experience to me. It fixed everything in my life. Everything was okay. And I chased that until I came into the room with the Alcoholics Anonymous. I was angry. I did not want to be alcoholic. I did not want my mom to be alcoholic. I didn't want the things happening in my life, but they were happening. And I think that recovery from alcoholism, or at least for me, was a process. It didn't happen overnight. But I want to tell you about, to compare the way I was when I was a teenager and then when I got sober at the age of 21 to where I am right now. And that is I changed from a kid who didn't want to be an alcoholic to a guy who's incredibly grateful to be alcoholic. And the reason I'm incredibly grateful to be alcoholic is because I get to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything that I value in my life is a direct result and a gift of recovery. And I think back to that kid back then, judging my life and thinking about what was wrong with it, as if I knew any better. And then I look at my life today and I think the thing that I perhaps was the most afraid of or wanted the least in my life is the thing that I value the most. And the thing that brought about every gift that I have been given in this life. And I have been given a lot of gifts. I have a great relationship with my mom. I've got a great and have had a great relationship with Dave. I knew Dave's sobriety date. You know why? Because I've known him almost since that day, since 1977. I think we met, right, Dave? And I think about this, that of all the people in my life, other than family, I've known Dave the longest. Isn't that something? What else? I was talking about my gifts. Okay, I've got three great kids, and as I said, the jury's out on whether or not they're alcoholics. They're going to be, but today they're not. I've got a beautiful wife who I met in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a gift that is. And, you know, if I had it my way, I wouldn't be here. You know, I would have missed all that stuff. And so it started as perhaps some anger, perhaps some a lot of negativity about my situation. But today I'm extremely grateful. And I think the process of going through that, how did I get from point A to point B, is the steps, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I remember, I don't know if anyone relates to this when they're drinking, but every problem I had was somebody else's fault. Anybody identify with that? And if you grow, yeah? And if you grow up with an alcoholic, man, you have a perfect thing to point to. Am I right? Right. And especially one who has often, I've heard her say this statement. I'm really glad you didn't say it today, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. She used to say this: James, every problem you have has my name on it. So I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it like my mom. James, every problem you has my name on it. And I was like, you're darn right it does. And then she'd say, and every solution has your name on it. Now, yeah, how about that? Nah, I want you to, I don't believe that for a second. not the second part, the first part. Because to think that every problem I have is a result of having an alcoholic mom is, like, where's God in that, you know? And I've had this, I don't know, this belief in life that problems or issues or whatever are to be avoided or not to have. I don't know if anyone relates to that. Like, the last thing I want is to have something I gotta deal with or whatever. And then as I look back on my life, the greatest gifts I've ever received is as a result of dealing with those very things, right? And so I don't believe that every problem I have has my name on, my mom's name on it. What I believe is every problem I have has my name on it. And the reason I believe that is because that's what I've learned here in AA. Is that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that that I produce and manufacture my own misery, regardless of my circumstances. And this is what I believe. I believe I have the personality that I would manufacture misery regardless of who my parents are. Does that make sense to anybody here? And sure, I have a convenient... perhaps a convenient thing to point to, but no, it's not because of that. It's because I'm an alcoholic, because I'm selfish, because I'm self-centered. And that, and I don't know if I believe every solution in my life has my name, but I believe every solution I have in life has God's name on it. And that that is the answer to every problem that I have. And boy, when I was new to AA, that was not what I believed. I remember, you guys know that line in the big book where it says, so our problems we think are of our own making? You know that line? Man, when I was new, that was not good news. That was not good news. As a matter of fact, I didn't believe it. I read that part of the book and I thought, and that may apply to you. That would apply to me. Today I believe it. And today I think that is where the true freedom lies in my life. And so I guess along the road, I learned to take responsibility for my life. And then along the road, through a lot of work, through the steps and through work in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I moved into this amazing space called forgiveness. And my mom talked a little bit about that. And what a great place to be to forgive. And a lot of freedom comes from that. But I want you to know, I don't think forgiveness is where it's at. I don't think so. I mean, it's good. Don't get me wrong. It's a good place to be. But I think the best place to be is where I believe in my heart that there's absolutely nothing to forgive. And that it's all a gift. And that's where I believe it, for me today, that's where I am with this alcoholism family disease thing, is that I am so grateful for everything that I've experienced, because everything I've experienced in my life has led me to be here today. And what a great place to be, huh? What a great place to be. And if I had had my way, I would not be here, you guys. And I believe that if I had had my way, where I would be is dead. That's what I believe. But I think God had a different plan for me. So here I am. And then So gratitude is, that's the place to be, man. Because that's a good feeling. And I'm going to tell this quick story. I was married with three kids. Went through a divorce some years back. And as I was kind of breaking up with my wife, I got a hold of this CD. Anybody have a CD of the month clubs or whatever? I got this CD, and on this CD it said, Jane from Tallahassee. I said, I've never heard of her. I'm going to throw this in the old CD player. And, man, you want to talk about a story? I was blown away, and I was, like, in tears, and I thought, man, I can't wait to – I hope I meet her one day. And then, yeah, and then August of 2009, we ended up at the same place, which is in Jacksonville, Florida. And I remember sitting at breakfast with my mom, and I was like, tell me about this Jane gal. I mean, what do you know about Jane? And she's like, well, honey, you're married, you know, but to me. But what she didn't know is it was kind of approaching the end. But anyway, so I met her that weekend, met you that weekend, and she was cool as heck. And then we became friends. Facebook friends. And while I'm not a big Facebooker these days, thank God for Facebook. You know why? Facebook has this thing called a relationship status. You guys ever watch that? Okay, so here I am on Facebook going through this divorce and everything. And this is about 5 years later. So this is the end of 2013, I guess it is. And she and I were friends, and we kind of were acquaintances, basically. And then my relationship status changed around the same time hers did. Like, check this out, a relationship. So pounce I did, and yeah. I said, I got this great idea. My mom lives in she lived in Tallahassee, still does. My mom lives in Jacksonville. I said, I got this great idea. I'm gonna pretend like I'm gonna go visit my mom for Thanksgiving so I can go meet up with Jane, which I did. And I'll leave out the details, but we've been together ever since. And, yeah. So you wanna talk about a gift? I wanna talk about family recovery. I am incredibly lucky to be married to you. And, I have this life that's, I just pinch myself. I mean, I got this great relationship with my mom and Dave and my kids. And then I get to spend my life with Jane. And how fortunate can a man be? And if it were up to me, I wouldn't have ever chose this life. But here I am, and I'm done. Thanks. I love you guys.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jane. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 24th of 1996. And my home group is Tallahassee Central Group 909. Dick and his beautiful wife, I saw. There you are. I am so grateful to both of you for having us here. And we met a couple of months back, and you mentioned this, and I was so excited to be asked to do not only this, but to do it with my family, you know, to do it with my, how lucky am I to have the amazing Polly P and Dave P as my in-laws? I mean, you know. And I actually met them way before that I met James, and I've just loved them both, you know, upon laying eyes on them for the first time. Anyone who's been in their presence knows exactly what I'm talking about. So I love you, and I'm so proud of both of you. And I want to thank you for your stories today, too, all of you. You know, I love hearing people's stories. And I love hearing stories about relationships. So I honestly feel like my greatest gift in family recovery is being able to rebuild my relationship with my family. But I'll talk about that in the next couple of minutes. But for now, I always like to start by doing some kind of centering thing. And because it is Gratitude Month, and because it's, Thanksgiving is next week, let's all just kind of close our eyes for a moment and take a minute to thank God for the many things that we have to be grateful for. I'm grateful for my faith, for my health, for the fact that I live a comfortable life. I'm grateful that I'm in the midst of this beautiful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result, I'm grateful for my serenity. So I want to just tell you my version of that story while we're hot off the trail of James's story. So I remember when this was one of the first conventions that was a biggie for me, and I was so nervous. And I remember I was sitting in the audience watching him do his talk, and like Polly just alluded to, he was a bad boy, you know, and I always had a thing for bad boys. And so anyway, I remember thinking, listening to him, like, oh boy, we would have been trouble if we were using back in the day. You know, he was a hippie and he loved, you know, rock and roll and Led Zeppelin, and you know, he moved to California to be like a beach dude. You know, I was just like, wow. So anyway, at the end, you know, when you go up and you thank people, I went up to thank them, and the person before me moved away, and it was almost like, huh! And I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with them. Isn't that weird? And then, you know, I gave him a hug and I said, thank you so much for sharing your story. And then I looked down and I saw a wedding ring on his finger, and I was like, darn it! I was off on that, you know? Darn! But anyway, so as he said, we became Facebook friends. And through the AA grapevine, I hear all of a sudden, oh, I just talked to Polly, and you know, her son James is going through a really difficult divorce. And I was like, oh, that's too bad. And so then, you know, I saw his Facebook status became, you know, he became single. And as he said, you know, he came up to visit his mom. And it was beautiful, beautiful timing, because my parents were visiting me in Florida for spring break when I got the first phone call from him. The phone call that said, Jane, I'm going to come visit my mom. Can I come up to Tallahassee and take you out to lunch? So we hung up the phone, and I was like, Mom and Dad, this is it. And they were like, oh, here we go again. You know? But I was like, no, this is different. I know it. I feel it. I felt it from the moment I laid eyes on him. And, you know, lo and behold, here we are. You know, we ended up going on that date, and then we did the long distance relationship thing for a year and a half. Him in Chicago, me in Tallahassee, and then we decided to go for it. And he said, you know, I really want to come to Tallahassee. Now let me preface this by saying I come from a big Irish Catholic family, and I had never even cohabitated with anyone. You know, because my parents are still alive, and I think that would upset them, you know. So, and also, I had never been married, and this is when I was 53. So, he's like, I think I'm going to move to Tallahassee, and I was like, well, if you're going to move to Tallahassee, you better put a ring on it. And so, anyway, so we went to Europe first, and he put a ring on it, and yeah, and we got married actually just over 3 years ago. And I just love sharing that story of, you know, happiness. And I love that my parents were there from the inception. You know what I mean? Because, folks, I'm telling you, my family of origin means everything to me. And the pain that I put them through, oh my gosh. So I know we're here to talk about the family afterward, but I want to talk about the family before for just a little bit and share with you, you know, the tragic wake that I left in my past. First of all, I was born into an amazing family. My birthday was just 2 days ago. Happy birthday to me. And I just turned 57, and every year when I call home, my mom talks about how it was the happiest day of her life was the day that I was born. And she did the same thing 2 days ago. I come from a big family, 5 kids, but the 2 kids before me actually went the whole 9 months, and after 3 days died from a lung thing. Actually, there was a Kennedy born in the White House that died of the same thing. It was around that era. It was like the lungs weren't fully developed. So can you imagine my mom, like, wow, 2 babies that I would have had a brother, brother Stephen, and a sister, Marianne. And they both just lived for, I believe, 1 2 days and 1 for 3 days. So my mom says, you know, everyone was just so thrilled, and I was the day I was born was the happiest day of her life. And I was a happy kid, and I came from a really wonderful family, you know. We went to Mass every Sunday. I went to Catholic schools. And I didn't start drinking, believe it or not, besides my first drunk, I was 14. But then I didn't start drinking until I went to college, you know, and then I went bonkers. And so my family didn't really have, you know, like Polly did, a front row seat to what was going on with him. Mine was pretty much behind the scenes. This is the day before a cell phone, so we just, you know, I left in September, I called home at Thanksgiving, came home at Christmas. They didn't know what was going on, you know, in between. So, but it became more and more obvious what was going on with my behaviors and my radical change. And so I just want to say that, to cut this long story short, mine kicked in when I was older. And it was progressive, and it was quick. It was quick. I reached the status of being an alcoholic and an addict very quickly. I was probably full-blown by the time I was 21. And so anyway, I did a lot of cool things. I traveled and all that. But my family situation started to get worse. I stopped getting invited to family functions because I would always just embarrass my family when I was at them. And that really made me react in a way that was sort of rebellious to my family. I felt like I always had this fear of living a half-lived life. So my excuse was always, I'm just sowing my wild oats. Don't worry about it. I'll be cool. I'll get over this quickly. Leave me alone. Let me do my thing. And they just didn't understand it. And I was filled with, of course, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, pride. That really started kicking in. And I'll make this short, but my drinking and drugging career lasted 14 years. And it came to, quite literally, a crash ending. And I did not have a safe landing. Mine was very tragic. I was vacationing with my boyfriend at the time, and we were down in the Florida Keys, and I had a DUI manslaughter, and I was driving, and my boyfriend was killed in the accident. Some of you know part of my story, but can you imagine what that did to my family? Can you imagine what that did to his family? I can only imagine what it did to his, but I can tell you what it did to mine. It tore them apart at the seams. And especially my mother. You know, my mother was filled with such anger and guilt and shame that she, like, disowned me. Now, my father, he's the one who I thought would have disowned me. My father was my rock. My father was the one who showed up. My father was the one who was there for me. And it put all of my siblings in a very precarious situation because they saw what it was doing to my parents. Let me just say, my mom and dad just celebrated 61 years of marriage. And the only time that they almost got divorced was over my stuff. And that upset my siblings so bad, so they kind of just decided to back off and stay out of it. But they were able to get my parents to go get some help. And thank goodness they went to, it's not Al-Anon, it's called the Parents Support Network of New Jersey, and they went to, and they do the 12 steps, but only then did my my mom start to open up to want to have a relationship with me, and that was years later. So anyway, I went to prison for 5 years, and you know, it was in prison where I got to take a good hard look at the consequences. One of the worst ones was really I felt like I lost my family. It got me to look really seriously at my powerlessness over situations. Let me tell you, prison does that. And it also got me to look at how unmanageable my life was and to truly embark on this 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in prison is when I did a lot of instrumental healing. But anyway, one of my favorite lines from the Big Book that really propelled me forward is, be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. And that line is the one that I held on to the most when I was in prison. And also the fact that, you know, I had to work not only on forgiveness and self-forgiveness, but also redemption and ultimately salvation, you know. And so I kind of got into the mindset, I'm grateful for the 5 years that I did in prison. I'm one of those that's really grateful for them. I want to share this little aside. So not too long ago, I got asked to speak at a gratitude thing down in the Florida Keys where the accident happened. And the judge who sentenced me actually came to the AA gratitude dinner. And I got to thank her for actually saving my life. Because I really, I know I needed that 5 years in prison because I had no idea who I was anymore without drinking or drugging. And I'm also grateful that I got, my family had time to settle while I was in prison and relax and not be in that state of worry. My mother today says, Janie, for 14 years we waited for that phone call. And quite frankly, we weren't surprised when it came. So anyway, since I've been out, I actually have been out of prison since 2001. It's been miracle upon miracle rebuilding my life. But again, I can't say it emphatically enough. The greatest miracle is that I rebuilt my relationship with my family. You know, my mom and dad, I can honestly say, are proud of me. And I'm best friends with my siblings again, you know. And, you know, I'm the godmother to many of my nieces and nephews. And you know, life is just really amazing. So I wanted to also very quickly just talk about James, because I feel like he is my new family. And, you know, I've never, as I said, been married before. And I can't believe that I am today capable of being in a relationship. And really, it's thanks to you guys. And it's thanks to the principles of this program. For me, the main spiritual principle that we practice in our marriage and that we live in our relationship is that when you give, you get back. I mean, it's as simple as that. And that goes with every relationship that's in my family. I happen to have one of the most giving mother-in-laws in the world, and I hope that I give back, you know, at least equal to what you give me. That's how it works. Right, Dave?
That's right.
And and I feel like it's like that with my family too. And to finish off, I want to just also say, that you guys are my family. You know, everywhere I went, God put like a family in my life. There was one when I was in prison too. They were my family. You know, it's amazing, but this family is really a special one. You know, I don't have to rebuild a relationship with you. I just step into it. It's really cool, you know. But thank you for helping me to rebuild my relationship with my family. Again, the greatest gift I can honestly say in my recovery has been my family and getting them back and making my new family with James. And I know this is going to be kind of corny, but I want to finish it off with this really cool blessing for partners. So if you have a partner, think about your partner now. And And if you're single, think about your relationship even with God, you know. Now we will feel no rain, for each of us will be a shelter for the other. Now we will feel no cold, for each of us will be warmth for the other.